Welcome back to Broad Appeal, Part 3, The Good, the Bad, and the Crazy, Michelle Pfeiffer. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How you doing, Bri?
I'm good, Sean. You know, this is one of those ones where even though we're moving forward in time, we're also moving backward in time because this final bit of Michelle Pfeiffer is actually one of her very first movies.
Is it her first movie?
I think it might be her first feature film. We'd have to ask Pfeifferologist Nathaniel Rogers to confirm that.
But Wikipedia just won't do.
What film are we talking about? We didn't have too much crazy to choose from with Michelle, it has to be said.
That is true. So we chose the sequel the world was clamoring for in the early 80s, Grease 2. If you really want to know what I want in a car, well, I'm looking for a dream on a meat machine with hell in his eyes. I want a double the skin. Be wild as the wind, and when fine nights, I'll be holding on tight to a cool rider, a cool rider. If he's cool enough, he can burn me through and through. Now, we have already said that Michelle Pfeiffer is a musical performer. She sings in the Fabulous Baker Boys, she sings in Hairspray, and she burst onto screen, she burst onto prominence in Grease 2, the sequel to the acclaimed 1970s meets the 1950s musical that we all know and love with John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. Yeah, and this time they did something completely radical where they flipped the characters. So Michelle Pfeiffer is the punky, rocky, pseudo-bad girl, and the gorgeous Maxwell Caulfield plays the British loser. What's his name?
His name
Max.
Is Michael.
Oh, Michael.
Michael Carrington, I believe. Michael Carrington. And the way that they connect all this to the first movie is that he's Sandy's British cousin.
Yeah.
So Olivia Newton-John apparently had a British cousin. Was she meant to be British?
Well, she was Australian.
Yeah, okay. I guess it's all the Commonwealth.
You know, Grease is so peculiar because she's playing this all-American kind of, like, farm girl, but for some reason they had to make her Australian in Grease. I never understood that.
And I also have one question about how people view the 1950s. So, do people think that everyone in the 1950s was Italian? Okay? Because basically, the most famous 1950s character is Fonzie from Happy Days, which is Fonzarelli. And in this one, Michelle Pfeiffer's character is Stephanie Zanoni, and she's dating a guy named Johnny Nogarelli. Like, I don't, as a Sicilian person myself, I just don't get this. But anyway, I think, like, the big discovery with this film that we just really couldn't stop getting over for a while was Maxwell Caulfield.
Oh my god, he's so gorgeous. And you don't like blondes, and no, you couldn't help yourself either, could you?
I've never liked a male blonde, I think, ever.
Female blondes, yeah, I mean,
female blondes, I could gaga for them. White Oleander, I mean, I had to clean up the bed sheets afterwards. But, no, honestly, like, Maxwell Caulfield, we were just mystified. Like, I don't think we'd ever heard of him or knew anything about him. And then, like, he is so gorgeous, so dreamy. He can't sing. Let's get that out of the way.
He can't do much of anything.
No, I would say, actually, he acted reasonably well the role of, like, the sexy good boy. He's basically Sandy's cousin who's come over from Britain, and he, like, you know, he's a straight-A student, blah-bitty-blah-blah-blah, but actually, you know, he's really the most beautiful man on the screen. No one seems to notice because they can't get over the fact that he's, like, you know,
has an accent.
Yeah, he's an accent, and he's, like, academic. And so basically the whole movie is him kind of learning to ride a motorcycle and be a cool kid so that Michelle Pfeiffer's Stephanie will finally, you know, actually wake up and realize that he's the hunkiest guy around.
Yeah, wake up and smell the HP sauce.
So that's basically the plot of the film. The one thing I would say about Maxwell Caulfield, like, we were like, well, surely he's got to have had a kind of amazing 80s filmography, you know, where he was, like, being the hunky boy in lots of other movies. And he didn't.
No. Funnily enough, though, after we had watched the film, I told our flatmate, Teo, that we just watched Grease 2. And he was like, oh, yeah, Maxwell Caulfield. He was just on Emmerdale. So for those who are listening in the United States... Emmerdale is one of the three soap operas in the United Kingdom. Emmerdale is the one set in rural farmland.
The taxonomy of British soap operas is London Urban EastEnders, Northern Urban Coronation Street, and then Emmerdale Rural.
Northern Rural.
Northern Rural. And if you're into the West Country, you've got to go to the radio for The Archers.
Yeah.
That was a sidebar. But, like, basically... Just Maxwell Caulfield for a minute here. We were looking at his Wikipedia, and we were like, I've never heard of any of these movies. And they have a reverse Sally Kirkland phenomenon.
I was just going to say that, actually, yeah. He goes from playing, you know...
Explain what the Sally Kirkland phenomenon is.
Okay, so the Sally Kirkland phenomenon is where you go from playing Woman in Clinic to having an Academy Award nomination.
It's literally... At some point, pause this episode and go Google Sally Kirkland's Wikipedia page.
Now, we love Sally Kirkland.
Yeah, we love her. She frequently converses with Sean on Twitter whenever he tags her.
I like Sally. What can I say? I think Anna is an amazing film.
Yes. So, yeah, Sally's like, Woman in Clinic, Hooker in Clinic, Hooker. And then suddenly...
Oscar. Clinic. She plays a clinic as well.
Then suddenly, Oscar nomination. Maxwell Caulfield is like... leading hunk in big, you know, movie sequel Grease 2, and then it's like man in diner bank clerk, like, yeah. I don't know what happened to him. So anyway, yeah, this was his one halcyon golden boy claim to fame. There are a few other, like, big surprising names in the credits. Some of them have, like, 1950s Hollywood cred. The A principal of the school is played by Eve Arden. That was all, you know, that excited me. Who plays the substitute teacher who teaches them about sexual reproduction?
Wretched reactionary Republican Tab Hunter.
Is he a Republican?
Oh my God. I think Michael Shulman wrote this piece for The New Yorker about how the voting process was changed and how some Academy members were, like, shifted into the emeritus status. And Tab Hunter just comes across as this... psycho Republican.
Oh, Tab.
Reactionary psycho Republican.
Yet another gay man who's just selling out the radicalism. But he's funny in this.
He is. He's the substitute teacher that teaches them about reproduction.
Reproduction.
That's it.
Yeah, so they basically, it's just like that whole song is like a series of double entendres about, like, stamens and pistols.
Yeah, and fit Italian lads grabbing their crotches.
And women with large breasts. They're just like, I think on my notes for this, I probably wrote the word tits about 47 times. And probably the person who has the biggest tits in this entire film, and someone who I didn't even know had a film career.
Yeah, whose mother had to strap down her tits.
Yeah, that person, of course, is least famous second-hand daughter, Lorna Luft.
Yeah, the great Lorna Luft.
Lorna Luft. I just literally almost fell out of my chair when I saw the name.
He wasn't
Lorna
even
Luft.
Sitting in one. Just to make matters worse. I think Lorna's great in this. She really plays up her mother and sister's kind of, like, hamminess.
Michelle Pfeiffer is one of the pink ladies, and there's Lorna Luft, and there's a couple other ones, yeah?
Aren't you glad that Lorna Luft and Michelle Pfeiffer were in a film together?
Well, that's what I mean, and that's, I guess, the definition of crazy. Yeah, here you have Lorna Luft, Judy Garland's daughter, Sid Luft's daughter as well.
While we're at it.
And Joey Luft's sister. And Liza's half-sister. Here she is. I just think of Lorna Luft as, like, from a completely different universe. And she's just acting alongside a nascent, as yet unformed Michelle Pfeiffer. And they have quite a few scenes together because actually the kind of same guy this kind of interchangeable Nogarelli Italian stereotype who is completely without any charisma. He, like, has been with Michelle, but she's a bit sick of him, and so he starts fooling around with Lorna Luft. So they're in this kind of weird triangle, love triangle. It's just a fascinating representation of different acting styles. Because, like, Michelle Pfeiffer is playing a 1980s performance in this movie, right? Yeah. She's kind of playing cool. She's constantly wearing sunglasses. Like, I think I said to you, she sort of already seems like she's slumming in this movie, even though it's her, basically, her film debut and no one knows who she is. Because everyone else in the movie, Lorna Luft preeminently, is, like, hamming it up big time, playing every double entendre for, like, the most that they can get.
Completely mugging it up so Jack Warner will cast them in something.
Whereas, like, Michelle just feels like she's in something much slicker and much more from the Gordon Gekko era, would say. If you were watching this in 1980, whatever it is, would you be saying this person is a star?
That's actually a bit difficult, because we're biased, aren't we? I mean, I would say she's gorgeous. She's fun.
I think what you watch and you think is, like, this person... And let's admit, like, Grease 2 is kind of fun in a truly, like, bad and insane way. It makes the plot of the original Grease seem like, you know, the Brothers Karamazov. Because it honestly, like, nothing happens in this entire film, yeah? It has absolutely no plot. And so the fun of it, I guess, is just the goofiness and the silliness. And all these people all around Michelle are being really goofy and silly. And I just feel like Michelle seems to be almost sleepwalking through this movie. By which I don't mean that she's bad. I just mean, like, she doesn't actually seem to be, most of the time, acting with any of her scene partners.
Yeah.
I guess probably her best number that she has is... Cool Rider, yeah, which is the one where nerdy hunk Maxwell Caulfield is kind of, you know, asking her out on a date, and she's like, no, 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 man, I need to get with a cool rider, not an ordinary boy, a devil in black leather. And then, you know, she sings well enough, and she climbs up a ladder, and she dances around, and she sashays, but she just kind of seems to be slightly, like, going through the numbers and slightly bored to even be in this thing. She's definitely not a starlet thinking, like, oh my god, this is my big break, I've got to outshine Lorna Luft.
Yeah, but then, like, haven't you tapped on something about Michelle Pfeiffer, which is her style, which she always kind of feels a little bit like she's had a few tokes before she's gone on. You know, Catwoman is quintessentially that, too. So I think Michelle Pfeiffer vacillates between two particularly good styles. One is kind of nervous energy,
mm-hmm.
which you also see in Batman Returns as Selina Kyle initially, and then this kind of post-orgasm couple of tokes type of Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah,
that's why I think actually I relate to her a little bit.
What, so basically you're either nervous or post-coital.
Yeah.
Those are your two moods.
Yeah.
This is a weird thing to say, but when I think of Michelle Pfeiffer, I do think of orgasms. It's just something about the way her lip curls, her face, like, we talked about this in the Age of Innocence episode. There's so much kind of, like, breathy edging and just kind of like, I'm nearly feel like I'm coming. And I feel that's the way that she performs Making Whoopee and the songs in the Fabulous Baker Boys. Like, she performs in a very sensual way a lot of the time. And yet it doesn't feel like va-va-voom Jane Mansfield, Marilyn Monroe. She somehow weds an intellect and a mind with that sensuality, you know?
Of course.
So that even here where Stephanie Zanoni is supposed to be basically another ditzy girl, like she doesn't understand Shakespeare and Maxwell Caulfield has to, like, tutor her in how to do Shakespeare, you just kind of see her being like, yeah, if I just get through this Grease 2, like, maybe they'll give me better movies to be in.
Well, they did. It was called Scarface the next year.
I had this idea of Mr. Right, remember? Which is a stupid idea, right?
Right.
And then all out of nowhere, he shows up. Like some dream or something.
Who?
Mr. Right.
All right.
And then the crazy thing is that I've seen him twice now. And both times he's wearing these goggles. I don't even know who he is.
Mr. Right.
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 Don't you think that's kind of weird? Not weird, weird, but like exciting weird.
So what's the problem then?
Well, the problem is that maybe he's just not everything I imagined. What if behind those goggles he's just like some ordinary guy?
Can we just kind of run through any of the other crazy elements of Grease 2? Because I think as we were watching it in the middle of the film, we were thinking to ourselves, okay, is this movie actually crazy or is it just going to turn out to be bad? Some fun, crazy things about it. Yeah, let's whip through them. Reproduction is definitely one. You really liked that number.
I thought it was great fun. Yeah.
Why did you like it?
It was catchy. It had a lot of sexy teens talking about reproducing with each other.
And it has absolutely no plot function.
No. I like the one about them conning your girlfriend into having sex with you.
In a nuclear fallout shelter.
Yeah,
not the wokest song that's ever been performed in a musical.
No.
Maxwell Caulfield, basically the minimal strand of plot is that he starts teaching himself to ride a motorcycle, and then he just puts on a motorcycle helmet and some glasses, and he looks like Marlon Brando in The Wild One, and everyone's like, oh my god, who's this like unknowable guy who can really ride a motorcycle? And like, no one realizes it's just the same British kid that used to be wearing a cardigan.
Yeah, also you notice the way Michelle gets with him even though she's never seen his face. I mean, it's very sex club, isn't it?
Like, literally,
like leather.
That's true. Yeah, she's totally into him because he's the cool rider, but she like rides on the back of his motorcycle. She never asks him to take off his motorcycle goggles.
No, she's a fetishist essentially. she gets off on the leather. She doesn't need sex.
You know, of course, she was going to star in Scarface only a little while later, so I wonder if she and Al Pacino had discussions about his experience on Cruising, because basically, she's cruising for the same leather daddy
well,
that
she
he
is.
Was
yeah,
around the same time.
Wow, Brian, you've put it all together.
I really have. Just call me Brian Synthesis Mullen. Ladies and gentlemen, go back and listen to that Cruising episode.
It's one of our best, actually.
It really is. Anyway, carrying on with the crazy things in Grease 2, there's all this crazy mistaken identity plot. But I think, like, for me, the final section of the film is where it just comes on full-on crazy. So, like, all the way through, all the kids in the high school are basically getting ready for this talent show. And do you remember what the girls' act was? So Lorna and Michelle and the other girls, what's their shtick?
Well, the whole number of months of the year, and they play particular seasons and months, am I right?
So that's right. They play different seasons. So Lorna is summer. She's in this like swimsuit that shows off her tits. And then she has this crazy headdress that has like golden rings on it. Mm-hmm. And then Michelle comes out. And did you also notice that, like, another way that Michelle stands out in this movie is that her costuming is quite different from the other girls?
Yeah, hers is like kind of like an Isaac Mizrahi style. Then the bouffant set 50s, like, losers of the rest
of
the
film. For those of us who are less sartorially aware, like, how would you characterize the Isaac Mizrahi?
Well, I mean, Isaac Mizrahi did a few nice kind of, like, bag dresses.
Yes, basically, you loved them because they're, like, I believe you described it as a shapeless bag that hides her bangin' bod.
Yeah, do you see, because that's how, another way where I relate to Michelle Pfeiffer as well, is that I like to wear basically shapeless garments.
That are kind of oversized. Yeah,
yeah. So when you take my clothes off, you see that I've got a nice body underneath.
LOL, as hundreds and hundreds of people have recently discovered. But anyway, Michelle is wearing these baggy things. Like, I basically dress like Maxwell Caulfield, like, you know, my dramaturgical cardigans that I love to wear.
Yeah, but you also have a visibly fit body, and you show it off, you know?
Thank you, darling. Oh my god. Let's finish this podcast really soon.
So we can go to sleep.
Anyway, so this crazy pageant happens. Michelle is playing Winter, and she comes out in this kind of weird diaphanous gown that's shaped like a Christmas tree. So they're performing their four seasons, but at this point, for reasons in the plot that I can't really recall, she thinks that the Maxwell Caulfield cool rider character has died in a tragic motorcycle crash because there's been a kind of like...
Nobody has been found.
Yeah, there's been like a Rebel Without a Cause style motorcycle thing where he's gone like flying over the edge of the cliff and she thinks he's died in a fiery motorcycle accident. So while performing in this Christmas tree dress, she suddenly has like a psychic break and a traumatic dream sequence where she and the cool rider, she's dressed in like a Grecian gown in this dream sequence. She's like running through like rubble and smoke, and then he's in like a bright gold motorcycle suit, and they like make out.
Stephanie, please don't cry.
Oh, it all seems so unfair. Just when I found you
to know your name.
The only thing you have to know is that I love you. And you're the only one who can keep our love alive. So Stephanie, don't forget me.
I promise.
And then we like return to reality and she's back in the talent show and the entire audience is applauding. And you're like, but wait a minute, she was just experiencing like a traumatic psychic break.
Yeah, she lay there.
Was she continuing to sing in the Christmas tree song? But then, just when you think that the movie can't get any crazier.
Well, remember, she wins.
Yes, they win the talent show, and she becomes like prom queen or something. And so they jump ahead to, honestly, the most over-the-top production number in any non-Mel Brooks movie, which is
the luau.
Yes, and they have a giant Hawaiian luau with, like, a flaming pool that has, like, fire in it, and Michelle and Johnny Nogarelli are, like, marched in as the prom king and queen by shirtless teenagers in dressed in, like, Samoan grass skirts and all this stuff, and then a motorcycle gang invades the luau.
Oh, what about that teacher who has the nervous
nervous breakdown.
Nervous breakdown at the very start of the film. It actually got quite a belly laugh out of me. And then he has kind of a similar nervous breakdown where he nearly drowns.
He just falls in the pool. I mean, literally, at this point in the movie, there's so much frenetic activity that is just literally like motorcycles riding through the shot. Like, every cast member is just like running around, like seemingly without purpose, screaming, jumping into the pool, being lit on fire, like having a food fight. At one point, I'm not quite sure why, but you said it reminded you of Nightmare on Elm Street?
2.
Why is that?
Freddy's Revenge.
Why is that?
Well, because in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, there's a pool party in which Freddy, they break with the established tropes of Freddy Krueger, and he somehow comes into the real world, and he, like, terrorizes a bunch of sexy teens at a pool party. This is just like that, except, you know, without the, you know, violent deaths.
The razor claws. Yeah, but it does have quite a lot of, like, comic carnage. And then basically in the end, you know, Maxwell Caulfield's identity is revealed, and there he is with Michelle. And, you know, I have to say, like, even though they're both really beautiful people, when they finally get together, like, their numbers that they have together have absolutely no heat.
Yeah, they don't have any heat together.
And maybe this is why Maxwell Caulfield, he ended up on Emmerdale, because he was just lovely to look at, but there was not much else to him.
Mm.
What kind of mood would you say someone has to be in to watch Grease 2? Like, what would be the ideal viewing circumstances?
If you're flatlining, that's a really good mood to watch it in.
I think it would be quite fun if you were, like, with a bunch of people doing, like, some kind of, like, sing-along type thing or drinking game, maybe? Yeah?
Yeah.
Anything that would just basically numb you to any form of sense or logic.
Yeah, if you can black out halfway through, that'd be fine too.
So just think, you know, basically no one else in this movie catapulted themselves into fame. They were either on the way out, Tab Hunter.
Or you were born into fame, Lauren Luft.
Yeah, and remaining static at the lower tier. So really, I guess we should thank our lucky stars that this crazy-ass, not-very-good sequel with, frankly, not-very-catchy tunes.
True.
It launched one legitimate star, a star who has given us so many other wonderful roles, yeah?
Yeah. And I am really glad that I have rediscovered Michelle Pfeiffer.
Did you have any kind of concluding thoughts in 2017, which has been a terrible year in so many ways, but hopefully will be remembered as the year when Michelle Pfeiffer returned to us? What are your last words?
Gorgeous glacial beauty with a secret. Back in our lives.
Thank you, Michelle. We hope we see you many, many more times.
Yes.
So that has been our first installment of Broad Appeal, the good, the bad, and the crazy. We have done a trilogy for the very first time. How do you feel?
I feel great. I've been on an amazing journey.
So it's been more like Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, rather than Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, and the Sith. Something about the Sith.
Oh, is it Revenge of the Sith?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good. It's been a decent trilogy.
Yeah, it's been decent, yeah.
We'll leave it up to you listeners to decide how you feel, perhaps with a rating or a review in the iTunes Store Apple Podcast section. Really, really, please do leave us some stars. It helps more people discover the podcast. People should also follow us on Twitter, shouldn't they?
Yeah, so we're at Broad Appeal Pod on Twitter. We have individual Twitter handles. He's at BA Mullen Speaks, and I'm at Sean McGovern X.
And Shawnee, who is the next actress that we will be giving the good, bad, crazy treatment to?
Brian, we're looking at our favorite actress, Karen Johnson.
Better known to you by her Jewish moniker, Whoopi Goldberg.
Yes.
Yeah, and I have to say, when it comes to the bad ones, we've had a lot of choice.
Yeah, and don't forget crazy as well. Yeah. They overlap quite a lot.
Yeah. So if you want to dive into the amazingly varied filmography of Whoopi Goldberg, join us in 2 weeks' time for more good, bad, and crazy Broad Appeal.
It's been great. Bye, Brian.
Bye. Now you see just how the stamen gets its lusty dust on through the stigma. And why this frenzied chlorophyllous orgy starchy spring is no enigma. We call this quest for satisfaction of what class?
A photoperiodic reaction.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's very good.
Hey, I'm lost. Where are we?
Chapter 2.
Page 5.
Reproduction.
Reproduction. Put your pollen tube to work.
Reproduction.
Reproduction. Make my stamen go berserk.
Reproduction.
I don't think they even know what a pistol is.
I got your pistol right here.
Where does the pollen go?
Back here. Put your hand in your seat.